Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do it. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
Thank you very much. It's lovely to see so many of you here. Do you want to start with the good news or the bad news? The good news, all right, the good news is that the World Economic Forum predicts that gender pay gap is on track to close. Yay! The bad news is it's not for another 169 years. That's true. So if anyone's wondering why we're here today, that's one of the reasons why we're here. If you've come along to debate whether feminism is a good thing or a bad thing, you're probably going to be disappointed tonight. We're not debating the merits of feminism, just as we're not debating the merits of civil rights. What we're going to do, we hope, is to discuss what equality looks like, how it feels, what it makes us re-examine, and what has held it back. Do we need laws to change first? Do we need culture to change laws? Do we need men to back the movement, or is it something that women should be doing by themselves? Does feminism mean promoting women, or does it just mean equality? So here we are. Feminism for everyone is what we're going with, and this is our pretty stellar lineup here. Catherine Mayers, the president and CEO, co-founder, I should say, of the Women's Equality Party. An Attack of the 50-Foot Woman is her latest book. Jess Phillips, the Labour MP for Birmingham Yardley, author of Every Woman, One Woman's Truth About Speaking the Truth. June Erica Dorey, activist and author, FGM campaigner, who got feminism added to the A-level politics curriculum. And David Baddiel, Fame Not the Musical fame, My Family Not the Sitcom fame, actor, comedian, and latterly, can we say, explorer of parental dementia as well. We'll start here, leaving plenty of time for questions from you, and I really want this to be as inclusive as you can, so if there are things that are getting you going, just let me know, and we will get mics to you. It's International Women's Day. We've heard so many statesmen and women, but predominantly statesmen, heralding the advent of International Women's Day. So I'm going to start with a quick fire to each of you. Does it suggest that we have come a long way to recognise International Women's Day, or does it suggest we've got a long way to go? Catherine?
We have an incredibly long way to go. The fact that we have to have International Women's Day is recognition of the fact that the rest of the year is International Men's Day, as somebody sitting next to me once memorably said. The problem that we have is, in fact, that everything is just crammed into this day. So, you know, we all have our books come out around this day. We get licensed to talk about what needs to be done on this day, and the rest of the year, it becomes a side issue. We talk about women's issues as if they weren't things that applied to all of us, as if they were not people issues. So, no, it needs to be something that we can celebrate its abolition, but we can only celebrate its abolition when we get to gender equality, and that's it is going to happen. See, we've already got a disagreement on the panel here. It is going to happen,
Jess,
and we're going to figure out how.
You publicly confronted an MP who suggested we needed International Men's Day. What is your take on International Women's Day then?
Well, to me, it's been a bit like Christmas today. I got loads of cards, and
It's like I keep going to all these different events and it's like seeing my family and some you don't get on with so well. And so today has been my best ever International Women's Day. And bearing in mind that, you know, it was the budget today in Westminster and I didn't notice the budget at all, which it's probably not such a good thing. But what I mean, what Catherine is saying is absolutely right. Because it was the budget today, Alison McGovern, who is a colleague of mine, texted me from the chamber. She is an eminent economist. She knows loads and loads about the Treasury inside out. And she was sat in the chamber and she said, it's International Women's Day and we're 2.5 hours into the budget debate and not a single woman has spoken yet today. And that was, it certainly the economy was being treated as if it was a man's issue. So there is a definite need to have International Women's Day so that people like Alison can say, use that platform to say those things. Well, I don't want to see the abolition of International Women's Day ever. No. I like feminist Christmas. And
somebody's agreeing with you.
Yeah. A man with his phone.
Yeah, it was a man's phone.
Are we keeping you? But I don't want to see it abolished. I want more people than just people who go to fancy events in capital cities to be involved with it. I want it to be the day when women go into their boss and ask them what their gender pay gap at work is. I want it to be the day that people actually speak up and that. When I worked in Refuge, it was brilliant because we always knew that we were going to get a government bung on the day of International Women's Day. We'd be like, yes, what money are we going to get today? Because they always have to give us something. Mm. And duly they did today. But I want it to be the day where businesses think, oh, fuck, I've got to go come up with something to give to women in my workforce. I want everyone to feel that pressure on like you feel like buying soap for your nan at Christmas. I want businesses to feel like they've got to do something for women
but
on that day.
But not a bar of soap.
But not a bar of soap.
Every day. But we want them to feel that every day.
June.
About International Women's
Day.
Yeah.
Do you welcome it? Does it herald? Have you been going around saying Happy International Women's Day?
Well, I first of all start off by saying is I still consider myself a girl, so like I'm 18. I do think it's important, and I do think over the years it has been for me become a really stressful day because, as Catherine says, it's the one day, and so therefore I must. You know, this is my fourth event. I was, you know, spoken to 300 girls in the morning and then run across the whole of London. Like, it's International Women's Day and we have to make sure everyone hears me speak. And I do think the one thing that kind of worries me about International Women's Day is, again, who are the women that we are paying attention to? And I think that's something that I'd like to see kind of change in the next couple of years. I don't think we should ever have it abolished. I think it's quite nice to have a day when we are celebrating women's and women's equality and, like, things that we're kind of working towards. But it's, you know, who are we paying attention to? And very, very often, I mean, take this panel, the only woman of colour here, the only black woman, it's the fact that very often within feminist movements, we're only giving the platform to certain people, and that's something that I'd like to see changed.
David, how do you approach or broach International Women's Day? I noticed Justin Trudeau posted a video where he started off by saying, Happy International Women's Day. Do you feel that is an obligatory way of opening your sentences today?
No, I haven't done that. Essentially, I'm slightly wondering why I'm here, except to give a sense that this is the polar opposite of a normal BBC comedy panel show. That might be why I'm here. And also, I see myself as a boy. I don't know if you're...
Because you're 18.
I'm 52. I completely agree that there is a weird thing about International Women's Day, which is that it's totally necessary, and its necessity is because we live in a maladjusted structure. We live in a maladjusted power structure, which seems unapparent to people still. I was reading a book the other day called All Our Wrong Todays, which is a book about someone who comes back from a utopian culture, utopian society, on a different timeline to the one that we are, breaks into our timeline. And one of the main things he's in fact a man, so apologise for mansplaining, but one of the main things he notices is a kind of entrenched misogyny taken for the natural order of things. And I think that's what we still have continually. We still have this kind of incredibly entrenched, all the time, you see it all the time, versions of what gender is, which is entirely power-based. It's entirely based, I think, on creating an idea of woman as lesser, not equal to men. And until that changes, and I don't see it changing, I think you do need International Women's Day. And, yeah, I think you're right that when it goes is when that equality happens, but I don't know when that's going to happen.
And, Catherine, you took a very proactive step last year, starting the Women's Equality Party, which is a political party which wants what at its heart?
Well, politics has never worked for women. You know, we're coming up to the 100th anniversary of women getting the vote, and we're still in a parliament that has more male MPs now than there have ever been female MPs elected.
It changed this week.
Has it equalised this week?
Because of the Copeland by-election.
Do you know, this is one of those moments...
Well, you said it to be proud of,
but No, but it's one of those moments where you think, damn, because my book's gone to press.
Yeah. Don't worry, I put it in mine as well. And I got the number wrong when I spoke about it in the media, so don't worry.
Well, I will change that slightly according to... But the point is, there's this huge imbalance. I don't think that the mainstream parties work for women either. You need a party that is dedicated to dealing with gender equality, to focusing on gender equality, to building the intersectional space that actually looks at the issues of how different kinds of disadvantage intersect with being female and does that work and keeps the focus. See, Labour has done fantastic things in the past, and there are great women in Labour now, like Jess, who I would vote for, who I would like to see leading Labour, but they mask the problem of the big parties. And so the reason we started the Women's Equality Party is to keep and maintain that focus. But we also noticed something, which is if you saw what happened when UKIP started to win votes, what sometimes happened was that rather than challenging UKIP's positions, the mainstream parties contorted themselves to be more like UKIP. So we also got this idea, well, what about if we prove that gender equality is a vote winner? Will they start to contort themselves to be more like us? Strangely enough, yes, it turns out to be the case. And we've seen it now in every election that we've run. We have changed the conversation and pushed gender equality onto the agenda. And I don't know if Jess would accept that we're doing it actually to help Jess and other women MPs, but that
so
is...
So you are the UKIP for women.
We are...
They're bombing now.
We have taken the only good bit out of the UKIP playbook, and we are using it for benign ends. That is something quite different, but we're doing a lot more than that. I mean, it's just... But that was just part of the inspiration for it.
Jess, then, as a Labour MP, does it matter if Catherine's party takes women voters from Labour to her party? Does that matter in an electoral sense to you, or in an emotional sense?
Yes, of course it matters. I'd be lying if I said that, you know, yeah, I'd love to give out my votes to, like, better causes. That's not how politics works. It's about trying to win as many votes as you can. And this was always the argument about the Green Party that, you know, my dad drummed into me, a vote for the Green Party is a wasted vote because it is just going to get the Tories in. But he said rain got the Tories in. He thought everything. He was very paranoid about the Tories. Still is. But of course it matters. So I think that the Women's Equality Party, when looking at where they stand candidates... Would have to take that into account, and one would assume they would. Because actually, you don't want to.
Is that party a danger to you?
I don't want to be offensive, but I think in Birmingham Yardley, I'm not sure you get that many votes in Birmingham Yardley.
But the idea of us standing against you would be silly. I mean, that. Obviously, what we will do is choose our seats strategically. Now, we are standing against Labour right at this moment in time in Liverpool in the Metro Mayor election. But the reason we're standing there is because there were no female candidates. In all the Metro Mayor elections, there were 30 candidates, only 5 of them, including ours, as a woman. And Labour and none of the mainstream parties fielded women in seats that they could win. That tells you where politics is at the moment, and that's why we're doing it. So we have this fantastic candidate called Tabitha Morton for Metro Mayor in Liverpool. Vote Liverpool.
So, June, when you hear this, do you think that there is, you know, a strong element that a woman's party, political party, directs what the other parties are doing? Do you think that's how it works now?
So you think in terms of them being there, they can then kind of push the agenda?
Mm.
Okay. I think the first thing I wanted to say, and I'm not trying to be the confrontational one on this panel, although that was kind of the reputation people were saying behind, when you said, and again, I'm going to keep banging on about intersectionality and why it's important we think about that. 100 years ago, women got the vote. That isn't necessarily true. 100 years ago, white women got the vote. Yeah. In the US, black women didn't get the vote until after the Civil Rights Act. And, you know, you had suffragettes like Susan B. Anthony, and I don't want to misquote her, so I wrote it down and brought it with me. When she says, "I will cut off this right arm of mine before I will ever work to demand the ballot for the Negro and not the woman." Those are people that have fought for women's rights. And I'm not saying this to be divisive, but I'm saying this because I think it's important that we actually recognize the fact that, like you were saying, there are many intersections, and the ways in which race and class and gender and sexuality intersect is an important conversation to have. To actually answer your question now...
Well, don't you stay with that one, that's absolutely fine. In a broader way, do you think the feminist debate is racist or is uninclusive? How far are you actually going with what you believe here?
Do I think the feminist debate is racist? Do I think there are some feminists that are racist? Absolutely, yes. I will say that. You can all come for me online. I'm ready.
They don't need to. They're all here. It's fine.
But no. But because I do think, you know, within historically, when we look at feminist movements, for instance, when you had the 1913 march with Woodrow Wilson's presidency, the suffrage march, you had Ida B. Wells, who is a journalist, a black female journalist, anti-lynching activist, very, very, very highly regarded, who wanted to march but was told by the white women she couldn't march with them because she was black. That is just the fact. Do I think right now that a lot of the movements we have, that feminism does have problems with race? It absolutely does. I remember looking at Donald Trump's election and thinking, okay, well, he said all these awful things about black women, about, you know, Latina people, about Mexicans, but surely him saying, "Oh, I grabbed her by the pussy," I'm sorry if that offends anyone, I really did think that that would be the moment that things changed. In a really kind of fundamental way, because I understood that while people might not necessarily care about me as a black woman, as a disabled woman, they're more likely to kind of have pity for a white woman. And, you know, the fact that the election results came out and 65% of white women voted for Trump and 92% of black women voted for Hillary Clinton, 65% of white women voted for Hillary Clinton, just to make sure that's clear.
Would you only let black women vote?
I mean,
I'm serious.
But the thing about that is that when you look at the Clinton legacy and you look at the fact that you have a three strikes rule and mass incarceration and the ways in which, you know, Hillary Clinton say we need to bring back people to heal. These are not things I'm making up. These are things that were said 30, 40, 50 years ago. And the fact that they were still able to put aside all of those things and come out to support her. They did not have to support her. Black women do not have to give their votes to Clinton, considering the ways that that presidency affected their lives and affected the lives of black people at that time. But they were still able to put that aside. And yet, you know, you had white women putting "I voted" stickers on Susan B. Anthony's grave, who is a racist. You had, you know, all these things that we continuously have where you continuously put marginalized women into the corner, and then after the election you're all like, "Let's march, yay, women's march." And again, it's important, but it's like, we've been telling you these things for ages. We've been saying that there is a problem here, and the way that you look at, you know, Latina women and queer women and disabled women, and the way that you continuously sideline us is a problem. And so I'm very, very, very clear that I do not think feminism will actually achieve anything until people sit down and actually listen to marginalized women and how they feel and let them air their grievances before we can have any sort of united front. Because otherwise, we're banging heads. Because there are people who are angry and fed up with the way that they have been treated for centuries. And then there are other people saying, "Well, just kind of put that aside. I can't rip away my blackness and say, okay, you move there, and right now I'm a woman," because I can't mitigate those things. That is central to who I am. And so I think as feminists, we really need to, you know, think about the ways in which we are excluding and work towards including more people, because that way we're actually going to work towards a freedom that is beneficial to all.
Just let me let me ask you something on that then. Would a feminist movement or a feminist march have to be led then by a person, a woman of colour, or a black woman or a person of colour, for it to be something that you felt brought everyone behind it?
I don't think it necessarily has to be led by a black woman, but I think, again, with the Women's March, you saw that when it was going to be started out by three white women, and there was, again, a huge thing to that, because they were going to originally call it the Million Women's March, but there was a Million Women's March organised by black women, and then again they changed it to the Women's March. But I think it doesn't have to be like, okay, well, now white women all kind of take the back seat, although I have no problem with that. Let's make that clear. But I do think what we do need is to kind of make sure that we are getting as many different voices on board. I'm not saying that middle-class women shouldn't talk, or, you know, rich women don't have a right to talk anymore. I'm saying when you are talking, be aware of your privilege. That is all that is important. Be aware of the privilege that you have, the privilege that I have sitting on this stage. You know, I have privilege even as a black young woman who's disabled. I have privilege over certain women. Mm-hmm. And I think it's continuously working to acknowledge that and saying, oh, I'm sorry, I fucked up, rather than being like, you know, trying to absolve or create a reason, rather than just accepting, I made a mistake here, I'm going to listen to you now.
And I presume that's something that you, David, are acutely aware of, the position of men or a man in the sort of feminist agenda. What role do you think women, what role do you think men have to play in this?
Well, it's complicated, because I think what June's talking about in a way is the speaking over of voices that haven't been heard, and the last thing that men need to do in this debate is speak over women, which happens all the time. I mean, all the time. So I think that men have to, you know, let women lead in this debate. However, it's about gender, and gender obviously is both genders, and the way that women are perceived stems from a power dynamic between the two genders, and therefore it's a dance, and often a toxic dance that men are taking part in, and I just think men need to be more aware of what they're doing, and also what it does to the self-image of the male gender to constantly perceive women in the way that they are perceived. I mean, something that I wanted to mention, it's just a bugbear of mine, is that there's this thing this week with Emma Watson wearing a revealing top, and that led to a lot of discussions about what is a feminist and what isn't a feminist. But 2 days before, she'd been on the front cover of The Times, because she'd been at a premiere, and not a particularly big premiere, and she was on the front cover of The Times, as there is almost every day an attractive woman, a young woman, white woman, normally, on the front cover of The Times, and she is there to sell The Times. That's why she's there. And I'd say The Times, it's every single newspaper now, and every single media image, and almost every single, at a time when we see proliferating images, proliferating screens, unfortunately, the mainstream media, which is a term I hate because Donald Trump uses it, but the mainstream media is absolutely selling itself now in a corporate terms on the back of a particular stereotypical gendered idea of what women are and what women should look like. And that, people talk about the objectification of women in pornography, which obviously goes on, but that tends to mean that people don't notice the enormous objectification of women all the time, in everywhere you look, on the television, on the cinema, on women's magazines, in men's magazines, everywhere you look, we are faced with a particular one-dimensional idea of women that is designed to sell you something. And I would say for men, what that does is create an idea, a very narrow, just as that creates a very narrow idea of the female gender, of the male gender. For 7 years, I was patron of something called Calm, which was a charity designed to try and stop young men from killing themselves. Some of you may know this, but the greatest killer of young men, of men under 40, in Britain is suicide. And that is because young men tend to stick, particularly working class men who haven't been given the advantages perhaps that middle class men have been given, where they're able to find ways of expressing themselves or pay for therapy or whatever, they are not able to express what it is that has led them into depression. But what it is a lot of the time is an idea of what it is to be a man, and how they've failed in that regard. And that, I think, really lies on the same spectrum as this objectification of women.
To you two, when... Catherine or Jess, when you hear June with a very tangible grievance at a movement that, you know, she's expressed much better than I have, she wants to be part of but has been left behind, right? What, how does that speak to, as it were, that, you know, the feminism that you're pioneering? What has gone
well,
on
that's
there?
Precisely why I was talking about the need to create a space that is consciously intersectional and works on those things, and also that creates platforms
and
for...
And do you think that the WEP does that?
The WEP...
You're pausing.
I know I'm pausing because we don't call it the WEP, and you just got me to do that. We call it WE, because WE is this lovely inclusive acronym. We work very hard to do that. And, I mean, just even from the very beginning, one of the reasons that when Sandy and I got together and decided to give it a go, that we did not think that we would lead this party. And, indeed, I'm on a platform now, but most of the time I'm not the person going out and being on the platform for the party, because the party is not a platform for us. It is to create platforms and this space that is needed to have those discussions, to bring those voices through and to focus on exactly those sorts of issues. But it doesn't mean that that's an easy thing to do at all. And not least because there is a great deal of very understandable suspicion sometimes on the part of people in different marginalized groups who have traditionally been ridden over and had their voices blotted out.
So the reason I went back to the party question is because I started by asking, do laws need to change, mm-hmm. or do culture, does culture change, which drives laws? How would you approach this in terms of, you know, you see what your goals are, mm-hmm. right? You know what you want to change. How does that happen?
I think both cultures and laws need to exist. I think for me, especially as someone who I grew up in Nigeria, I spent the kind of first 10 years of my life there, and that was a country where even if in my house we had certain beliefs or people I knew had certain things about women and their place in society, the law didn't always reflect that. And it could be a real barrier knowing that even if the people around you wanted that change to happen, there weren't actually laws in place to enable that to happen. So I think there's a whole thing about culture and that cultures have to change. I think ultimately, even if there are laws and people don't fundamentally accept that, you know, these things are intolerable, misogyny is intolerable, you know, racism is intolerable, etc., etc., then it can be really hard to even have a world where people are kind of fighting for these issues. But I also think if you were then to have a world where everyone agreed but there were no actual laws in place, it would make it really hard to make sure that there was some form of justice.
I mean, this is... You started, Dave, by saying that there was something... I forgot your phrase, but there was something so systemic that people didn't almost recognise that it was the norm. Yeah. So I'm wondering how much of the world you think is driven by women's acceptance of a norm which you don't think should be there. I mean, what are the areas where you think women are too accepting of something that, you know, is blindingly obvious in your eyes, where you have a privilege?
I think, you know, June is absolutely right. There's a whole series of voices.
The events calendar is filling up here at Intelligence Squared, and to create each one, we obviously rely on some brilliant guests and onstage talent. But behind the scenes, there's also a producer, a production team, and the budget in the mix too. You've got to keep an eye on all of that stuff in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. And you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because it's super easy to get started. NetSuite exists in the cloud, you see, no hardware needed. So you're cutting IT costs too. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
You're a podcast listener, and this is a podcast ad. Reach great listeners like yourself with podcast advertising from Lips and Ads. Choose from hundreds of top podcasts offering host endorsements, or run a reproduced ad like this one across thousands of shows to reach your target audience with Lips and Ads. Go to libsynads.com now. That's LIBSYNads.com.
To denote the way that power and privilege is doled out in our society. But I think for myself, and I speak as, you know, as a Jew, so I'm aware that there's all sorts of ways in which race and religion create structures that you can't see immediately, and then you realise that you're being discriminated against or whatever. But I would say the base one is gender. I think the base way in which power exists in our culture and is often not seen as existing is gender. And I would say the way it exists more than anywhere else, and obviously race exists like this as well, but I think it's gender more, is by people thinking, oh, well, that's just the way it is. That there remains, I think...
Give us an example, because that's so interesting to hear. What? Give me a tangible sense of where that has happened.
Well, I mean, it exists in the way that... You know, I don't know the statistics, like Catherine will know the statistics, but there are still...
Well, it exists in millions of ways. So, for example, it is obvious that a woman is the one who has to take the time off work to have a child. It is just obvious, and people don't want to argue against that because it's as if, you know, we're arguing against maternal love. Yeah. And there's all sorts of things, assumptions that happen to us every single day that are entirely because of our gender.
But if I was going to actually, now that's absolutely right, but if I was going to put one example from recent times, it is the fact that Donald Trump and not Hillary Clinton is president of the United States, right? Because, I mean, it is... I didn't know that much about what was going on, but I did watch and think, okay... So he is, as far as I can make out, he's a sexual assaulter. He's a man who won't publish his tax returns. He's a bully. He's a narcissist. He seems to be in the pocket of Putin. She's done some emails, right? And as far as I can make out, there was genuinely, but not perceived as such by an enormous amount of American voters, a sense that there was something shrill, all the words that you imagine that people are applying to a woman who might be in power, something not quite right, something uncomfortable, a nasty woman, as Trump put it, about the sheer fact that this was a woman who might be in power.
Just on that, I mean, the research is really interesting because when she was Secretary of State, she was quite popular, but that's because she was in position. The moment that we see a woman seeking power, and I say we because, as June points out, white women also voted for Trump, we are socialized to find that in some way asocial, antisocial, bad, not womanly, and penalise women for that. And it is something that came into play with Hillary Clinton.
I want to come right back to that point, but just because there was this applause there, just put up your hand in the audience if you think... lights up if we can, just so we can get a sense. Who thinks here that Donald Trump won the presidency because he was a man? What would you say that is? More than half?
More than half.
Let me ask it the other way. Who thinks that Hillary Clinton lost the election because she is a woman?
Question.
It is the same question. It's sort of the same question.
Well, I went with it.
Madeleine Albright was the one that said during the election campaign, and actually I think repeated a phrase that she'd used years earlier, there's a special circle of hell for women that don't vote for women. From what you've just said, I mean, do you think that applied? Do you think that was taken seriously, or do you think she sounded jaded, out of touch? How do you read that? Is it important for women to back women for political office?
I think that women not supporting other women are playing into a self-perpetuating system. I think women should support other women. But it doesn't mean...
You.
No, but I'm not saying that you vote for a woman because she is...
I wouldn't vote for Theresa May. I'd literally rather almost anyone except Donald Trump.
But what you have to do is assume that women coming into politics, women seeking power, are at a disadvantage. So you have to actually examine why you're responding to them
I absolutely disagree with the idea that I have to vote, or, you know, that I have to support women because we're women and it's feminism and yay.
Would you vote for a black woman? Would you feel the imperative to...
No, not absolutely not. She doesn't, just because you're... And again, like, I know you said not because she's a woman, but I think... often when I look at, often when we talk about feminism, you see this online a lot. You're like, oh, you know, we have to support other women and like get, and it's important that we do support other women, but I'm also not blind and I'm not stupid and I'm going to support you with a brain on. Mm-hmm. And if there
exactly.
are,
that's,
you know,
that's
and if,
the best phrase, support people with the brain on.
But
you know,
that
means seeing the disadvantage.
Albright was saying was within the party structure, there was a special place. So it was during the primaries and it was about women in the party supporting a woman over not general voters. Just
it was
saying, oh, just
between
vote for
Hillary and Bernie, wasn't it?
And yeah. I think that whilst I agree I wouldn't vote for Theresa May, I wouldn't support somebody who was crap who was a woman if they were up against a really brilliant man who was going to be good for women.
Yeah.
I would never do that. But I do think that within institutional systems, and it goes back to the argument about whether you need a law or a culture change, I actually think we need structural solutions to structural problems, and that means laws, usually. And I would say, in a party sense, as somebody from a political party that has strange structures, that you have... I still don't understand half of them. Those acronyms, they're lost on me. But they... You have to. I would definitely say in the Labour Party, I would. If two people were similarly good, I would definitely support the woman.
Yeah, same. I would. If there were two candidates that on paper were the same, like you know, had the same beliefs, that I would. But if you know, you for me, it's again like if there's a woman running for something and I don't agree with what she says, or you know, that's going to harm me, I'm not going to
agree. Absolutely agree. But what we do.
But also,
need,
feminism gives you that freedom, and I think that's the thing we also need to have, is that feminism should allow women to, you know,
think that the women are a bit crap sometimes.
But if the American population voted for Donald Trump, on your understanding, because he's a man.
No, I don't think they just voted him because he's a man. They voted for him because a third of the American population are stupid. But but what I think there was a gendered element to it, and quite a strong gendered element to it, in the sense that, you know, he's so absurdly... He's like a cartoon of a boorish, you know, American, rich, white man. And also she fitted into a particularly easily dismissed by a misogynistic culture type of woman, i.e. she was older, you know, she had been traduced by her husband. That came into play. That became like, you know, how can we trust her when she was in a marriage, which is obviously...
Ended up being her fault somewhere
along the line,
didn't it?
But my point is that all sorts of gender sort of qualities and gender balances and gender imbalances were brought into play deliberately a lot of the time, and then sometimes unconsciously,
yeah. I think I disagree that that Americans voted for Trump because he was a man. I think a lot, for me, it was a lot more to do with around race. I really do think that was the key issue there. Because if you look at American history, any time we've taken 5 steps forward, we take 100 steps back. You know, you have, you know, slavery, Reconstruction. I'm not really going to go into all of this. I also can't kind of... It's a long timeline. But I think the point is, you had a black man in the White House, you had a black woman in the White House, you had a black first family, and that really pissed off a lot of Americans. And I think that was simply to do with, a lot of it was around, you know, was around race, yeah. And obviously gender played into it, but I do think, again, we've kind of seen this creeping, everyone says this creeping fascism, I hate to use these phrases.
June, I'm gonna pull us back slightly against all my natural instincts, pull us back from American politics for a little bit and just sort of stick to some of the sort of feminist issues that we were raising. And the one that you brought up, Jess, was childcare and parental rights. Now, I'm wondering if you think the simplest solution, which we're just now starting to sort of inject into, is this absolutely split period of maternity, paternity, you know, parental leave now. Do you think that would be society correcting something major? An economic.
Yes, I think that one of the single biggest things that we could do for women in this country, and it would affect all women, regardless of their class or race or disabilities, is that if we gave men, and people say I hate men, so I'm now about to stick up for them, I think men should be given exactly the same paternity rights as women are given maternity rights, because... A, my husband is just such a better father than I am a mother. I mean, he like knows the kids' shoe sizes and everything.
And is that something? Is that a conversation you have with Jeremy Corbyn? Is that?
Yes. Well, we definitely have a conversation about universal childcare, and David Lammy is really, really, really big on the whole fatherhood thing. So we're just starting to sort of try and get it through. But I have requested it of the government twice, and the reason I do it is not just because I do actually love men, not hate them, is because it would stop a woman, when she was sat in front of a panel of people, being a risk to an employer, because a man would be a risk, and a man would be a risk for the whole of his life, because, as Des O'Connor has taught us,
75.
You can have a baby when you're 100. So only older women wouldn't get discriminated against, and that is fine, because they are having it a really rough deal, older women, so let's let them have that for the team. We've taken their pensions.
But also, like, you know, flexible working hours and, like, co-sharing, job sharing. I think all of those things are important in the ways that we actually allow women to raise families and work. Yeah.
Because that law change would change the culture. It would stop us thinking that it's a woman's job to raise her children.
It has in the Nordic countries actually made already a big difference, but there is a key point to it, which is that you have to have a use it or lose it portion for men, so that you actually make
so
this.
They have to.
They basically, well, they can. They have to take it or they lose it. And the other point, of course, is that because there's a gender pay gap, you have to invest enough in this scheme that you pay sufficiently for men to be able to take time off work, because you have a gender pay gap, which means that men tend to earn more than women, and therefore they say, oh, we can't afford to take time off work.
The single reason that most women... I didn't choose to take the time off. My husband has not learnt to lactate, which I think is, you know, poor
shocking.
On his part.
Poor behaviour.
But it was nothing to do with the fact that I could produce milk. The reason I took time off work when I had my children was because my husband earned more than me, and I didn't care about... It wasn't about, it'd be such a child to be away from them. It was because we needed to pay the rent.
Yeah.
And I think that families sit down and think, oh, well, you know, you earn more than me, so it's probably better if you go back to work, because, you know, we can't live on my income. And we won't change that until we make... Basically, I want them to suffer. It's like I think equality will be here when there are as many mediocre women in Parliament as there are men in Parliament. And I feel the same way about as when men are having to struggle with having to negotiate their terms at work the way that women have to, then I'll be happy.
I've just realised something really curious about this panel, which is that David is literally never going to intervene or enter the conversation until I go up and sort of prod him with my biro. But do feel that you can, because otherwise I will sort of keep feeling that you're the limb.
That's the only interruption I'm doing.
Just me. Yeah. Do you think this is something that men would take? Do you think it's something that they want? And do you think it is an injustice? Well, the same level of paternity rights, not just a couple of weeks off when the baby's born, but do you think men are yearning to be more involved with their kids and their families and, you know, that whole period of bringing up children?
Well, actually, I do. I think, I mean, one of the things, I mean, you mentioned I'm doing a show about my family at the moment, and I did a film about my dad, and I don't know if anyone saw that film about my dad, and it was mainly about the fact that he has a particular type of dementia, but it was also, I think, about men and family, and about the fact that I'd grown up with a very, very sort of angry, absent a lot of the time, at work most of the time, dad. And what I've found, and obviously this is just my experience, and it may not be the experience of lots of other men, but is that the generational thing has not carried on that in a kind of cycle of abuse. What I've felt and what I see in most of the men that I know, and again, I'm in a privileged situation, I know that, but is that they've reacted to the coldness and absence and lack of sort of parenting that they've seen from their fathers with really, really wanting to be in touch with their kids as much as possible. And I mean, I do want that. I just do. I know I want to spend as much as time as I can with them. And that's an emotional and psychological shift as well as a cultural and political one. But I do think it's really important. I think it will gradually change everything.
Also, if I had 9 months off, then my husband had 9 months off, that's 18 months I don't have to pay childcare. That's 18 months that the taxpayer isn't going to have to fund the childcare. It would make much more sense to have that.
Yeah.
Completely improves productivity. You know, this is one of the things about this discussion that we're having is that the lack of gender equality is actually an own goal. You know, you want
to... It's terrible for the economy.
It's terrible for the economy. Yeah. One of the biggest, the easiest, fastest route to growth is to make progress towards gender equality. Yeah. So why the hell are we not doing it?
And June, I wonder how you come into this. You know, you're 18. Do you look at our generation and think, what on earth have you been doing? Why are you still having this chat, you know?
I mean... I'm lost for words.
Not for long.
Yes, I guess. I guess it's we haven't.
I mean, you know, if we look now, and it's a dangerous thing to do to look at student campus behaviour, but you know, what we see is the kind of no platforming, the I don't want to be offended, I don't want this, I don't want those speakers, all the rest of it, rather than the sort of, you know, the sort of activism that says, you know, go out and do this and change this. I wonder whether you think feminism, does it feel done to you? Does it feel lame to you? Does it feel...
Absolutely not done. And also not lame. It's the coolest thing. So, like, it is really cool, and I think it's important. But I think change is incremental, and it takes time. And I think what's important is that we don't stop having these conversations, actually. I think it can feel really boring to continuously talk about, you know, the need for childcare, the need for, you know, better maternal pay, paternity leave, you know, women on boards, like all of these issues that we're constantly talking about. But I think the minute we stop talking about them, then that's when I'm actually worried as like a young woman growing up in this world.
When I was your age though, June, those things didn't exist. My son was the first kid to ever get free childcare in this country. He was in the first ever year. So whilst things do change really, really, like, it's like painfully slow, but it in my lifetime, it has changed.
Let's get some questions. You can take us in any of the directions we've been and plenty more that you prefer. So I will... Yes, there's a hand there. If we can just get a mic down there. There's a purple hand waving here, if we can get a mic there. As it were, and there's one that's actually waving, and I love a wave. That's it. If you've got one more mic just there.
Like Catherine, I'm both American and British, and I'm fascinated at how allergic we are in this country to affirmative action. And if you look at how fantastic affirmative action was in North America, especially for civil rights, and I'm interested in the panel's perspective on, is it time for us to be a bit more activist?
Great. Thank you very much. Yeah.
Yes.
Yes.
In Sydney, film festival Chopfest, they anonymised their entrances this year, and the female directors went from 5% up to 50%. And I would love to see us force this endless chat where nothing actually happens to anonymising CVs, turn it into an orchestra audition where you come on stage behind a screen and they don't know what race you are or what gender you are. And I think we could force companies and in all sorts of different ways to get women into the room.
Great. That's great. Thank you very much. Let's work backwards then on that one. An anonymous CV, does that get around sexism, or does it just kind of hide underneath it? I mean, does it...
Well, you couldn't have it in lots of jobs because some of them, I mean, where I worked, I had to know whether you were a woman or not. So it would be difficult. But the government is about to do it. The government is about to anonymise all CVs because of a piece of research done into Muslim women being discriminated against. So it's about to go through Parliament.
I think it's a really good idea. It seems like a really good idea.
But it doesn't confront a problem, right? It covers it up.
No.
Well, not necessarily.
It helps to get people in. You know, yeah. Another question was about affirmative action. What you're actually trying to do is find mechanisms to make change, but in order to anchor that change, you then have to attack the underlying problem, the underlying bias. You have to make unconscious bias. You have to actually make people conscious of that bias and train them out.
Can I just say I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for affirmative action. So the party I am from is totally behind affirmative action and has been since 1992, that they insist that 50% of all of their seats have to have women as the candidates, and it's the only reason that we're anywhere near why we got over that number this week.
Why 50, Jess? Ruth Bader Ginsburg said to us on Newsnight last week...
Go 60.
Well, she said,
I'll be happy when all nine Supreme Court judges are women, because they've had nine men for the last, you know,
years. I'm totally up for that, but I would also be up for affirmative action in every single government policy that we have. Every single penny in the budget today, I want to know exactly what is being taken from women and what is being spent on women, because all of the spending on roads, on rail, on bloody cables that go in the ground and all this stuff that's meant to make us productive, 1% of those jobs will go to women, and the government shouldn't be allowed to spend that money unless 50% of the taxpayers are being represented.
Jess is absolutely right. Affirmative action is absolutely essential all the way through. Where I would think the only difference is that I am absolutely convinced that we need to have a separate party that holds the feet to the fire, that has this. We have had this in every single aspect of our policy right from the beginning, and we don't lose focus on it because it is the priority.
Okay, let's get some more questions in. We've got 10 more minutes. Yes, first hand there. Oh, I can't keep looking at the front. Red top there, please. Man there.
Man.
Yes. And you've got a mic. I'm just going to trust you, number three. Choose somebody great. Right, where did we start? Yes.
So I'm
try and just keep them as brief as you can. No, I know you haven't even started, but I'm just saying that.
I'm 19 and I'm disabled and I'm LGBT, and I think you've got to, talking about intersectionality is so important, but also just asking who'd be willing to do the day off. Okay, I might have disadvantages in other places, but I'm a student, I don't have kids to look after. So I think not just intersectionality, but inclusivity. Oh, and yes. Kind of my question is, how do you, you know, we need to bear in mind the fact that other people have different, you know, I'm a feminist and it's very important to me, but if I'm going to have more of an issue if something affects me and my disability. That's got to come first. Mm. And I think kind of take into consideration that there are so many different things that affect it, and making intersectionality more of something that, and inclusivity, something that more people are more aware of, because, you know, I'm white and I'm, you know, and I can get, get away with not looking like I've got a disability, because it's a hidden disability, and sexuality is not an obvious thing, but, you know, it's something that we've got to look further into. And I just kind of wanted to ask, how can we make that something that people are more conscious of, just generally, you know, not just in Parliament, but day to day and in the workplace and so on.
Okay, thank you very much. Let's come back to that one. Number. I'm going to say red jumper. Yeah, red dress. Thank you.
I'm 19 too, and I basically wanted to ask the same question, which was, I come from an incredibly privileged background, but how do I pass the mic? And June, I wanted to ask you that. Like, how do I go about that?
Great. She'll tell you. who did we have next? You, sir, I think. Yes. Have you got the mic there? It's just coming up to you now. This gentleman here with his hand. That's it. Yeah.
Yeah, I work in an all-boys school, and we have an active feminist society, which I'm very proud of.
Oh, brilliant to hear!
And they're here this evening, not organised by me. They organised it for us. I think they struggle sometimes with being male feminists, and they provoke a reaction. My question is it difficult to be a male feminist? Hmm.
Do you want to ask the man, presumably, on the panel, do you? Or... We'll work that one out. And number three, yeah.
I wanted to ask Jess about, and Catherine, I guess, about Parliament specifically and access for women in Parliament. And something stuck out for me that happened probably a year ago with one of your colleagues, Tulip Sadiq, who, heavily pregnant in the chamber, left to eat some food and was really heavily castigated when she came back. And I think the words that they used towards her were, "You're breaking parliamentary protocol and you're bringing down womankind by doing it, by suggesting that pregnant women can't sit for 3 hours and not eat." And being pregnant with my first child, I know that it's quite hard to sit for 3 hours and not eat. And I just wondered, it seems to me that that's a really off-putting thing to say to a young pregnant woman, pregnant with her first child in Parliament. And what changes are possible to make Parliament accessible for women?
Great. Okay, let's start with that one, working backwards then. I mean, you know, a sort of good, strong F off probably should do it, but does that actually change?
It was a woman who said
the...
it to Tulip. If it was a woman who had been pregnant in the house and had never had... And I think that there is a definite difference between the sort of the idea of, I suppose, your Sarah Palin's versus your Hillary Clinton's, your Theresa May's versus your Harriet Harman's, is that Tory women in the UK, they are much more willing to appease their male colleagues, and to try and fit into a world. So when Tulip was being told that, she was being told it like, I was pregnant and I didn't want to let womenkind down by asking for special treatment. Whereas people like me say, you should give me special treatment.
If there are Tory women here, you can disagree with that if you want.
Well, Tory women will do this thing where they go, well, it's not so much that I'm a feminist, I'm more of an equalist. because it's constantly trying to appease something, and difficult women are much harder to elect and much, much harder, which Hillary Clinton found out to everybody's sorrow. But the thing that needs to change in Parliament is there's a number of things. We should work better hours. The hours are ridiculous, especially for people with families. Why don't we start work until 11 o'clock and then work until 8 at night on just a basic day, and that's if nothing exceptional happens, and obviously exceptional things happen every single day. And we're often there till midnight for no reason whatsoever, and you know you're going to miss your child's parents' evening because you're being demanded to stay there to lose a vote.
And one of the things that people don't see is how incredibly male Parliament is behind the scenes. So you see the scenes in the House of Commons and you can see how few women there are compared to men, but all the back rooms are full of men. We ran this campaign to map sexual harassment and assaults in the UK, and people wrote a postcode on their hand and took a picture of their hand, and it was extraordinary how many people had the postcode for the Palace of Westminster on there. And yet, to me, who worked in there as a journalist, it wasn't extraordinary at all, because it is actually endemic in that place and it is part of that culture.
Right. Let's go and... just, I think I might put this one in your hands, David. As a male feminist, presumably you call yourself a male feminist, you don't have a problem with that. What message would you send out to...
I understand that it's really brilliant that there is a feminist club at your boys'. Yeah, woo! It's absolutely fantastic. But I understand your point that it might sometimes feel difficult to identify for young men or any man as that, because there are a lot of twats around who will make fun of you for that. You know, it's exactly the sort of thing Piers Morgan will tweet annoyingly and unfunnily about if you call yourself a male feminist. I mean, it's partly just it's a slightly weird phrase. I mean, interesting enough, that point about Tory women, I think it's probably right, actually, as far as Theresa May whatever goes, but I think one reason why I'm a feminist, actually, is that as I've grown older, most political models, i.e. being left-wing or right-wing, whatever, they just don't fit for me anymore. I can no longer impose a political model on life. I can no longer say, I am left-wing, so therefore I think this about this subject and this subject and whatever. And about the only thing that across the board I think, well, this is clearly, there are inequities here, it is wrong that this exists, that it should be changed, is gender. I mean, it just seems obvious to me that gender inequality exists, that there is, as I said earlier, a whole raft of ways in which people have bought into without realising it, power. So I'll give you a very quick example, going back to American politics briefly. There was a brief moment when Hillary Clinton was choosing who was going to be her vice president, her running mate, where it was floated that might be a woman. And that was considered to be utterly ridiculous, right? The idea that you could have the same gender as both president and vice president, well, that would be ridiculous, obviously, if they were both women. And obviously, she would have no chance. I mean, literally, she would have had no chance. And that is so ridiculous and so, as you said, endemic, that there is something wrong with the way that we consider power and how we ascribe power, that I just think, well, as someone who believes that I have some ability to have insight into the world, I have to be a feminist.
Well, and the fight for gender equality the fight for gender equality does not belong just to one part of the political spectrum. Yeah. One of the problems with the left sometimes has been that in an attempt to solve all inequalities, women just get sent to the back of the queue. Which is, you know, we were talking about that problem of virtue on the left, of assuming that because people say the right things, or even like think the right things, that they'll do the right things. Yeah. Not true. But that's the other thing, is this notion that you can solve you have to.
But also, I think that virtuous thing with the left shades into machismo. I think that there's because they're all think of themselves, even when they're old, as like rebellious and kind of charged with testosterone and fighting the good fight and all that stuff.
I think then it's macho and it's very over male, I think.
We're running out of time, but I'm going to let June finish us off by talking to the young woman who described herself as a privileged white feminist who wants to pass the mic. What would you say?
Pass the mic.
Yeah.
No, I think we make it a lot harder. We make it a lot harder for ourselves. Like, what can I actually do? Look for women who are facing all these, having, visible or invisible barriers in their life, and literally be like, how can I help you? I think we don't have to have grand acts of feminism. A lot of the time, I spend a lot of today talking directly to schoolgirls and saying, oh, I've done this and I've done that. And one of them actually said to me, she said, oh, but, that's a lot. Like, how have you managed to do it? And I said, look, I didn't start campaigning today. It's been 5 years. Mm-hmm. And I know I'm 18, but I've been doing this since I was 13. And it's gradual and it's little things. I started off in my school talking about these issues to my friends. And then, two, 3 years down, I was at the UN, but I didn't wake up at the UN. It didn't work, didn't work like that. But I think it's literally that. Go out into your local communities and find these support groups. Go out, give your time, volunteer. If you have money, give money to groups. Look at groups that typically don't have access to these things. There's a really great site in the US called Together List. Because often we might give money to Planned Parenthood, might give money to really huge organizations, but there are smaller organizations working directly with queer women, with disabled women, with black women, that you can give your money, your time, your resources to. And I think that lovely girl you're saying about how we can make people more aware about intersectionality, and that is to force it into discussion. One of the things that I did when I came on this stage, and one of the first things I said is, I'm the only black woman here. It's a fact. And that might make you uncomfortable, but I'm not interested. I'm stating a fact. And I think it's you have to make these things that feel uncomfortable to us to become the norm. And I always say, 100 years ago, what we considered to be a terrorist was a woman demanding the vote. And now the idea that women in Britain don't have the vote would blow all of our minds. So again, it's you have the power to make what is abnormal the norm. So use that power, whether it's in your workplace, at home, within your family, to force that change. And if we collectively do that, then we'll be able to galvanize and have kind of incremental change around the world.
Thank you very much. Thank you. Thank you all for coming. We're going to draw it to a close, though. We've all got the kids to put to bed. Joke. Well, sort of, but thank you to this amazing panel and to all of you for coming. And do come to our next ones. Thank you all very much indeed.